Our scripture reading this morning comes from 1 Samuel chapter 26. 1 Samuel chapter 26. Now the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is David not hiding in the hill of Hakiah, opposite of Jeshimon?" Then Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him, to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul encamped in the hill of Hakiah, which is opposite Jeshimon by the road. But David stayed in the wilderness, and he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness. David therefore sent out spies and understood that Saul had indeed come. So David arose and came to the place where Saul had encamped. And David saw the place where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army. Now Saul lay within the camp, with the people encamped all around him. Then David answered and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, the brother of Joab, saying, "Who will go down with me to Saul in the camp?" And Abishai said, "I will go down with you." So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and there Saul lay sleeping within the camp, with his spear stuck in the ground by his head. And Abner and the people lay around all around him. Then Abishai said to David, "God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Now therefore, please let me strike him at once with the spear, right to the earth, and I will not have to strike him a second time." But David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" David said furthermore, "As the Lord lives, the Lord shall strike him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall go out to battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. But please take now the spear and the jug of water that are by his head, and let us go." So David took the spear and the jug of water by Saul's head, and they got away. And no man saw, or knew it, or awoke, for they were all asleep, because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. Now David went over to the other side and stood on the top of the hill afar off, a great distance being between them. And David called out to the people and to Abner the son of Ner, saying, "Do you not answer, Abner?" Then Abner answered and said, "Who are you, calling out to the king?" So David said to Abner, "Are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not guarded your lord the king? For one of the people came in to destroy your lord the king. This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, you deserve to die, because you have not guarded your master, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is, and the jug of water that was by his head." Then Saul knew David's voice and said, "Is that your voice, my son David?" David said, "It is my voice, my lord, O king." And he said, Why does my lord thus pursue his servant? For what have I done, or what evil is in my hand? Now therefore, please let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. But if it is the children of men, may they be cursed before the Lord, for they have driven me out this day from sharing in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, 'Serve other gods.' So now do not let my blood fall to the earth before the face of the Lord. For the king of Israel has come out to seek a flea, as when one hunts a partridge in the mountains." Then Saul said, "I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will harm you no more, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Indeed, I have played the fool and erred exceedingly." And David answered and said, "Here is the king's spear. Let one of the young men come over and get it. May the Lord repay every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For the Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I would not stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. And indeed, as your life was valued much this day in my eyes, so let my life be valued much in the eyes of the Lord, and let him deliver me out of all tribulation." Then Saul said to David, "May you be blessed, my son David. You shall both do great things and also still prevail." So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place.
I invite you to take your Bibles, if you have them, and turn to 1 Samuel chapter 26. Of course, that's the text that we've just heard read a few moments ago. 1 Samuel chapter number 26. And in 1 Samuel 26, in this account of David once again encountering King Saul and having an opportunity to take Saul's life, in this account we see David responding rightly to the serious life-threatening pressure that King Saul brought upon him. And that is to say that he acted in righteousness when the pressure was there. And we're going to consider today, as we look at 1 Samuel 26, what a righteous response looks like when pressure is brought into our lives. What's a righteous response look like when pressure is brought into our lives? Now, when we talk about pressure being brought into our lives, we must confess right away that our pressure does not equal the pressure that David felt in 1 Samuel 26. I know some of your stories. I don't know all of them, but I'm pretty confident that if we were just trying to measure who had the most stress in his life, 1 Samuel 26, David's story takes the cake. It's worse than all of us. We're talking about a man who's had to flee his home, relocate his entire family, including relocating them, some of them out of the country. He had to contend with a rabid king trying to kill him. And all the while, he's supposed to lead a band of 600 men, and it seems, if you read through 1 and 2 Samuel, that they had their households with them, so we're probably talking in the thousands of people. And oh, by the way, David is doing all of this under the age of 30. May well be around the age of 25 at this point. Now, whatever pressure or stress or difficulty that you're facing, it isn't the same thing or at the same level as David. We should just admit that. And if we try to compare ourselves to where David's at, it's like we end up sounding like a 15 or 16-year-old, and I'm not knocking you if you're 15 or 16-year-old, and I've heard 15 or 16-year-olds make statements like this, and I probably made statements like this when I was 15 or 16-year-old. I am so busy, right? I've got all this stuff that I have to get done. And I hear that from a 15 or 16-year-old, and in my mind, and sometimes with my lips, I say, you have no idea, right? You haven't had a clue. You don't have a clue. We say, or sometimes they'll say things like, you know, I just must be getting old. I forget stuff, right? You know, like, you know, it gets worse, a lot worse. However, the reality is that when we were 15 or 16 years old, or if you are 15 or 16 years old, we do face, and we did face, pressures that sometimes feel overwhelming. I remember that. And that was true for me in times when I was in my 20s and 30s, and now in my 40s, and if the Lord tarries and God allows me to stay on this earth, that will happen again in my 50s and 60s and 70s and beyond. Everybody has pressure that comes upon them. We all genuinely hope and pray that we have times when that pressure and that stress and those difficulties are lessened in periods of our lives. And I think most of us would say that we do have periods that are just good. But we can also all tell stories and accounts when just stuff is thrown at us that is just incredibly hard. There are pressures that are thrust upon us without any choice that we have made. And some of those are unrelenting. There are other times that we face great difficulties because of choices that we've made. And those can also feel unrelenting. And so while we may not measure up, if we're trying to look at the worst scale of my life compared to David, we may not measure up to him, but we all do face those times when we face pressure and stress and difficulties. What's a right response when that is brought to bear upon us? So I think David provides for us, he modeled a righteous response as he loved and served his God. Now, in order to see that response, we're going to work our way through 1 Samuel 26. David's going to show that response, and we're going to see three specific ways in which David responded rightly to the pressure he was under. And we're going to work our way through this text. We're going to note those along the way as we work through 1 Samuel 26. And from the three ways in which David rightly responded to that pressure, we're going to then conclude by looking at three lessons for our lives today when we face difficulties, pressures, and stresses. So we'll walk through the text, and then we'll come back and draw three lessons for us, and our time will be done. So first of all, let's just work through the text here of 1 Samuel 26 together. We begin in verse 1, where we meet the Ziphites, and we've met them before. If you've worked your way through 1 Samuel, they're a family clan in Israel, and they have come once again. This isn't the first time they've done this. They've come once again to rat out David. David's hiding, and they're going to tell King Saul where David is at. So they tell Saul exactly where David and his men are, and Saul brings, again, 3,000 men with him to capture David. And we say again, because this is the second account in 1 Samuel where Saul has trotted out 3,000 soldiers to try to nab David. This isn't the first time he's done this. And you just do a little math. David had his 600 men. Saul has 3,000. That's a losing proposition in most cases. So this is a terrifying thing. Now, those 3,000 soldiers are recorded in 1 Samuel 24. But also in 1 Samuel 23, as I mentioned, we have the record of the Ziphites ratting out David there as well. In fact, there's a number of similarities between chapters 23 and chapters 26. There are so many that some have thought that they're actually two versions of the same story. I don't think that at all. They're different and emphasize different themes. But nevertheless, David hears about Saul's coming, and he does so because according to verse 4, he has spies or scouts that are looking out for him. He had an organized military complex going on here at this point. And they informed him that Saul and his 3,000 men, they're on the way. So David moves around, which was no easy task, not to mention just the 600 men, but also probably their household to try to move and get away, to avoid Saul and his 3,000 men. Now, David decided to confront this matter again with King Saul. He's tried in the past. He's going to try it again. You may remember back in chapter 24 that David encountered Saul in a cave and could have killed him, but he chose not to do that because he respected the Lord's anointed king, and that is Saul. Even if that king was wicked in 1 Samuel 24, David withheld his hand from inflicting judgment upon Saul. Here, David is going to have a second chance. And so he and a man named Abishai go to see Saul's army encampment in verses 5 and 6. Abishai would have been David's nephew, by the way. He was also the brother of Joab, who will become very important later in David's life and in 1 and 2 Samuel. Joab was also David's nephew. The two of them took a great risk in doing this. There is no doubt about that. To get caught would mean instant death. I mean, and they go out at night, and you can imagine how careful of an operation this was. I like playing a good game of capture the flag, do so with teenagers every year. And we do some of our rounds at night when it's dark, and you do the whole thing where you got to belly crawl in the dark through whatever you're crawling through and work your way as far as you can down the field not to get caught. And sometimes that involves long pauses and waiting for people to move and hoping that they don't see you. Of course, the big difference between capture the flag is that, and what David faces is that if you get tagged and capture the flag, you are either out or you go to jail. In David's case, it would have been tagged with a sword, right? I mean, you're dead, right? There's no moving forward anymore. This is truly game over if you get caught at this point. This is a serious thing. Well, they creep and they see Saul laying down in verse number 7. The text also records that the Lord was with David because God had caused a deep sleep to fall not only upon Saul, but all of his military people around him. Abner was with Saul, and he's also asleep. And Abner was a military commander for Saul. Apparently, he's out cold. And since it's night, it's hard to know what is actually going on here and how David and Abishai identified Saul. Maybe there were torches or campfires that allowed some illumination. But no matter what, considering that they were close enough to actually get the sword and, the spear and the jug of water, this indicates that they got really, really close. You just have to imagine how quiet they would have had to been. They were close enough to see that spear sticking into the ground in Saul's water jug. But in verse 8, when Abishai sees who it is, Abishai states, God has delivered your, he's speaking to David, God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Now therefore, please, let me strike him at once with the spear right to the earth, and I will not have to strike him a second time. So what in the world is that about? Well, there's a good chance that this was the very spear that Saul had used to hurl at David twice. Remember that earlier when he was in the courtroom with the king and Saul threw the javelin, threw the spear at David? This is probably the same one. And Abishai was saying, I won't need two shots, man. I can get him in one right here and he will be dead. Well, David's response, like that to what he did in the cave in chapter 24, was to say, no. Do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? And here, by the way, is the first right response of David that is righteous. David recognized that it was not his job to go up against the Lord's anointed. He recognized that it wasn't his job to go up against the Lord's anointed. And that means that even when it was convenient and beneficial to him to do the wrong thing, David didn't do that. He did the right thing. Now for David, God had placed King Saul in power, not yet David himself. And in fact, David grounds his decision in God's plans for Saul as for motivation as to why he didn't do this. Notice verse 10, as the Lord lives, the Lord shall strike him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall go out to battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. So he said, Saul's going to die one way or the other. Either the Lord's just going to kill him, or his day will come. He's going to, you know, just like all of us, if it's appointed unto man, wants to die, and after this the judgment, he's going to die, or he's going to die in a battle. Someday he is going to pass. This I know. In the meantime, it's not my job to take his anointed job away. Now, what David did do in this case, however, is to make a point to Saul, as he had done earlier in the cave. So he has Abishai take Saul's spear and his water jug from the campsite. This would have been proof that David, in fact, had been there. And David uses them in just this way. He and Abishai go a long ways away from Saul's camp. And then he calls out. And it seems to be that we're still in the middle of the night here. It's dark. Because Abner, who's Saul's military man, can't see or recognize David at the end of verse number 14. But in verses 14 and following, David calls out Abner by name, and he almost taunts him. Notice verse 15, are you not a man? What kind of man are you to let someone come so close to your king? You know, you got nothing, dude. Verse 15, and who is like you in Israel? Aren't you supposed to be the top dog, the big cheese, the big kahuna? You're Saul's right-hand man, and you did nothing to stop this? And David told him that he deserved to die for this offense of not protecting the king. And I'm sure Abner in his mind is like, yeah, that's true, but I'm not going to say that out loud, right? This is a big problem for Abner. This was his primary job, was to protect the king. And to prove this all, David asked Abner to locate the spear and the water jug, and you can imagine him looking around and he can't find them. You know, maybe the fire had dying down, and so they're patting around in the dirt looking for the spear and the water jug, and they're not there. And here's David or Abishai holding him up in the dark and saying, clink, 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 guess what? They're over here. We have them. They're gone. But at this point in the conversation, Saul is awake, and Saul knows that this voice is the voice of David. Is that you, David? And David acknowledges that it was. And David asks Saul to explain himself in verses 18 and 19. What had David done that deserved this kind of treatment? And then David asks where the motivation was for this kind of treatment. If it was from God, then David would offer an offering, a sacrifice, to make things right before God. In other words, if there's a sin that I have done, Saul, I will make the appropriate sacrifice to God to atone for this sin. And the Old Testament law provided for that. Saul, if there's something I can do to make this right, I will make this right. But what you get at the end of verse 19 is that David knew that it was not God who had brought this upon David, but rather it was Saul. But if it is men, may they be cursed before the Lord. And notice this explanation, for they have driven me out this day from sharing in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods. Now that might require a little bit of explanation in our minds. David seems to be referencing some of the people who were opposed to him, probably at a minimum the Ziphites and of course Saul. The Ziphites were the people who attempted to turn David over to Saul twice. These people were troublemakers for David, and what they were in essence saying is, you are not welcome in the land. We want you out of here. Now, nobody likes to be kicked out of anywhere, right? Nobody likes that. David certainly didn't like that. But there's something more here than simply, you know, please get off my lawn. That's not exactly what's going on here. Because notice that David uses the phrase sharing in the inheritance, or to share in the heritage of the Lord. Now that may not mean much to you or I, but for David and the people of Israel, that's actually a really, really big deal. Because this is referencing the promises of God to the descendants of Abraham, the Jewish people, the children of Israel, that they would receive an allotment, a portion of land in the land of promise for their family. David was in his rightful tribe of Judah, and they were forcing him out. He could not stay there any longer. He was forced out. He was forced to not be able to lay claim to the glorious covenant promises of God. And think about this. It wasn't just him. He's got his nephew, two of his nephews with him. His parents have been relocated to Moab at this point. His whole clan had been forced out of Judah. And again, that may not mean so much to us. It's like, yeah, that would stink if you lose your property. But your property for the people of Israel was connected to the very covenant promises of God. David saying, you have tried to force me away from my God. You've undercut what is core to my belief. It's not quite the same thing, but it's like someone saying, you can no longer lay claim to be called a Christian or be part of a Christian gospel preaching church. And even more, he quotes them at the end of verse 19. They were telling him, go serve other gods. You have no place in the inheritance. You don't have a place to belong here among these people. Serve false gods. Door is closed. And you know, at some level, this had to have been tempting for David. The king of the nation had slaughtered the priests to God at Nob. The people he was trying to protect in the nation kept turning him over to that ruthless king. It would have been very easy for David to say, that's it, I've had enough, God is really not that good, I'm done, I'm out. That would have been tempting. But here's where our second right response of David is seen. David refused to be moved away from serving his God to going after false gods. He refused. Even when the pressure was great upon him, he still believed in and he still trusted in God. Now from here, David goes on to plead for his life in verse 20, and Saul in verse 21 listened to David, and he says some words that sound pious. He says, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do you harm. And that sounds really good, except for this isn't the first time that David has heard these kinds of words from Saul. And every time he says them, he turns around and chases him again. He's not going to believe these things. And in fact, if you read on to chapter 27, you're going to find out that David did not believe Saul. And I think as we progress through the whole of 1 Samuel, David was right to not believe Saul. Saul had lied repeatedly about his change of behavior, and I think he's lying here right now, and David does true. Saul did not trust in God at all, because we're going to see by the end of 1 Samuel that Saul's end is a total rejection of God's ways and a total rejection from God to him. David recognizes this, and he's going to be forced to flee from Israel. Well, after Saul says his peace, we need to pay attention to David's response in verses 23 and following. He says to Saul, may the Lord repay every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. That's a bummer from Saul, because we have not seen Saul do any righteousness or faithfulness for a long time. But may the Lord repay for righteousness and faithfulness any man, every man, For the Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I would not stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. Verse 24. And indeed, as your life was valued much this day in my eyes, I valued your life today. So let my life be valued much in the eyes of the Lord, and let him deliver me out of tribulation. And here we see the third right response when David was under pressure. David respected life under the fear of God. He valued Saul's life because God valued life. And from here, Saul blesses David, and David and Saul parted ways, with Saul returning to his home. And this, by the way, is the last time that David and Saul will have an encounter with each other. Now, what in the world does this mean for us today? How do we draw lessons for our own lives as we think about this text of Scripture? And I want to just again note with you, the three responses of David when he was faced with this massive pressure. Response number one, David recognized that it's not his job to go up against the Lord's anointed. Response number two, David refused to be moved away from serving his God to serving false gods. Even when the pressure was great, he still believed and trusted in God. And response number three, David respected life under the fear of God. He valued Saul's life because God valued his life. And each of these, I think, provide valuable lessons for us today. And let's just take each one of them and think about that together, and our time is going to be finished. First of all, David in recognizing that it was not his job to go against the Lord's anointed, it teaches us that even when the pressure is great, as much as possible, we are to respect the boundaries God has ordained in our lives. Even when the pressure is great, we are to respect as much as possible the boundaries God has ordained in our lives. Now, that's certainly true when it comes to the boundaries of authorities. Sometimes we face pressure from authorities in our lives, and if we were speaking this in many places in the world where some of our brothers and sisters face massive amount of pressures from governmental authorities to dishonor the Lord, this would be a really serious call to them. And honoring those authorities and respecting them as much as possible is a good thing. I know of a pastor who, when he was a young boy, He just graduated from high school, and he felt like God was directing him towards pastoral ministry. He wanted to go to a Christian university and get some biblical training, but his parents were against it. They asked him instead to go to a local college for a year and then decide. And after he sought some counsel, he agreed to that, submitted to it, and 1 year later, God had worked in his parents' house and heart, and they said, go. That was not easy for him as an 18-year-old young man to figure that out. God has since blessed him with many years of faithful pastoral ministry. Or we might think of a boss, or sadly even a government official, who could put pressure on someone to do the wrong thing. And even in those cases, as much as possible, respecting authorities in our life is something that we ought to attempt. But I would suggest that this isn't just about authorities in our lives. I use the word boundaries for a reason. Because David was operating on a higher principle than just merely authorities. In many ways, Saul was not his authority any longer. Saul, by virtue of the fact that he was openly sinning and pursuing David's life, had abdicated his right to be David's authority. David was respectful, but he's clearly not obeying Saul, because Saul wants him to come and be in his capital city, where he would presumably execute him. Not going to obey that. David was respectful, but he was not obeying that authority because he's on the run. But David still, in that situation, recognized that God had placed boundaries in his life. Saul was still the Lord's anointed. David was not going to lay a hand on someone he had no right to lay a hand on, even though there seemed, humanly speaking, every reason to do it. And I think that's true for us in a lot of ways in our lives, not just with authorities. You see, it's very easy for us to justify sinful actions, actions of wrongdoing, when we are under pressure, and to cross boundaries that we ought not cross because we think, well, it's just really hard and this is the right path out of here. If David had killed Saul, or if David had said to Abishai, I'm going to sneak out of here, whatever happens, you know, I didn't see it, right? If he had said those things, there's a part of us that would feel like he would have been justified in that. I'm under a lot of pressure right now. So I just need to get out of this. And we find this in other areas of our lives today. You know, I'm under a lot of pressure right now. Dad loves the gummies he can get. It's legal now anyways. So I just need some stress relief. Intoxication, that's a form of that. It's a sin. I'm under a lot of pressure right now. I'm under a lot of stress right now. So that's why I lashed out and yelled at that person. I'm under a lot of pressure, a lot of stress right now, so that it's okay that I checked out and I just didn't show up for work. I'm under a lot of stress right now, so that it's okay that I lied about that situation so that I could get out of that pressure. I'm under a lot of financial pressure right now, so it's okay that I cheated that person out of their money. They won't even notice anyways. And you can find lots of scenarios where it's like you can self-justify actions because life is just hard. Well, I'm definitely a middle-aged guy. I mean, by definition, when you're in 40s, it's like the definition of middle age. And I've lived long enough to know that, yeah, life is hard, but it doesn't justify sinful actions. God has actually ordained boundaries for our good. It's easy for us to set them aside because of our self-justification when we're faced with the pressure of life and stress upon ourselves. And when we do that, that's sin. That's sin. Lesson number two for us. You know, David refused to be moved away from serving his God to serving false gods, even when the pressure was great. He still believed in, he still trusted in God. And our lesson is we too are called to believe and trust in God even when the pressure is on. Look at verse 19 again. I just want you to see the audacity of what David says here. For they have driven me out this day from sharing in the inheritance of the Lord. And I mentioned this earlier, but this is the David's attachment. It's his attachment to the promise of God for his people. This is David's ultimate hope in God's promise, and David was not interested in moving away from that hope. And that's actually stunning, because there are many people, when bad stuff happens, they just give up whatever they're hoping in. Something goes wrong, it's like, forget that. I'm not going to trust in that anymore. We know this on silly levels and on serious ones too. I have a relative who was a particular fan for a long time of a particular baseball team. It was not the Twins. He had all the fan gear. He went to games. He had the jerseys. He had the autographs. He appeared to be a true fan, but he just got tired of his team losing and losing and losing. So one day, he just announced to everybody, I'm not cheering for that team anymore. And he became a Dodgers fan. And I'll just say right now, of all the teams not to cheer for, please do not tell me you're a Dodgers fan. I can't stand that baseball team. Bunch of LA snobs out there that just spend gobs of money. I won't rant any longer. But I don't like the Dodgers, all right? He became a Dodgers fan. And he announced it all over to friends and family and social media. And all of a sudden, he had new jerseys and new autographs. And he had new games to go to. Now, what happened really there? He got tired of cheering for a losing franchise that, quite frankly, continued to make one bad decision after another after another. They wouldn't spend money on the right kind of players, and he just got disillusioned with it, and he moved on. And in truth, there's actually nothing wrong with that decision morally. But for him, what happened was, it was like, this was not worth it anymore. My hope was lost in that team. It wasn't enjoyable anymore. Life was hard as a baseball fan, so I'm going to stop doing that and actually enjoy something. I'm going to move and cheer and move my allegiances elsewhere. But of course, we can think of something far more serious. I can think of a friend of mine who was pursuing full-time ministry as a young man. And he had a pastor that mistreated him and that he lied about him and wounded him and slandered him. He's clearly sinned against, and it hurt, and he let that hurt grow and fester, and he eventually began to doubt the goodness of God, and then he began to doubt God altogether. Today, he calls himself an atheist. He switched allegiances. How did that happen? Because he lost hope, and he was disillusioned, and he just slowly moved away. Now, those are two examples that are probably the most extreme of something silly versus something serious, but they both represent a potential problem we can face when we're under pressure. We can begin to lose our hope and confidence in something or someone when they don't measure up to our expectations. And that can be true of God. It would have been easy for David to fall prey to this. I mean, just think about this. In David's case, after the slaying of Goliath, and that's a long time ago at this point, after the slaying of Goliath, what has gone right in David's life? I mean, you know, you think about that. He was promised he's going to get all sorts of riches for his family. He's going to be given one of the daughters of the king. He's out there with the sling. Boom. Down goes Goliath. The head's chopped off. He goes out. David has slain his, you know, Saul has slain his thousands. David has slain his 10,000s. I mean, he is on top of the world. And then everything from here on out has been down, 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 down. Boom. Way down. Everything was going wrong. On a human level, nothing was going right. He had been deceived by Saul, lied to by Saul, had multiple attempts on his life, had to flee, had to relocate his family into the Moabite Witness Protection Program, and then had to run for his life while keeping 600 men and their families alive. And after you do that for weeks or months or probably at this point for years, you, if we were in David's shoes, we might begin to wonder, does God really care for me? Does he really care? Is God really good? Can he be trusted? Is he trustworthy? And in one sense, if David was asking those kinds of questions, we could, on a human level, empathize with that because it's easy to feel this way when we are under pressure. And there's a pattern that happens to people. A hurt, a disappointment comes into our life. God doesn't seem to do anything about it. God, please be aware of this, but the hurt doesn't go away. God, do you really care? God, it seems you don't care. God, are you really good? It seems that you're not good. And in such that kind of pattern, God suddenly becomes not part of the factoring of your decision-making process. He seems to have left me here anyways. Why would I care at this point what he thinks in my life? And we should be honest, if God had not been a factor in David's mind and heart when he was looking at Saul with that spear stuck into the ground, Saul would have been a dead man. But David had not moved his heart away from God. He still trusted and did not waver in God's promises. You know, we're going to sing in a few moments the hymn, Be Still My Soul, which reflects this, that we still trust in God even when life hurts. But a more recent hymn expresses a similar idea. Still, my soul, be still and do not fear. The winds of change may rage tomorrow. God is at your side. No longer dread the fires of unexpected sorrow. God, you are my God, and I will trust in you and not be shaken. Lord of peace, renew a steadfast peace within me to rest in you alone. And that was David's heart. It ought to be our hearts as well. We do not move away from the hope of God's promises just because something hurts. Third lesson, David respected life under the fear of God. He valued Saul's life because God valued Saul's life. And we are to value even the lives of people who are causing us hurt and grief. It's interesting again to note verse 24 where David says to Saul and of Saul, and indeed, as your life was valued much this day in my eyes. I think it's a powerful statement because this is the temptation that we might have when people put pressure upon us. You know, the temptation is that we might forget about them as people. And at a minimum, that means people who are moms or dads or sons or daughters or friends and cousins and so on. So it's easy to forget that the people who are bringing grief into our lives, that they have souls, they're people. But much more than just on a human level, that's a mom or a dad or a son or a daughter, much more than that, people, even the people who are bringing us grief and stress and sorrows, they are people who are made in God's image, people for whom Jesus has died, and people who will spend an eternity in some place. I just think about that. I mean, this is the guy who's bringing affliction into David's life, and he says, I value your life, Saul. Wow. I don't know if I'd feel that in that moment, right? I mean, I have to imagine if it's me, maybe I shouldn't say this out loud, but I'm just thinking about, you know, how hard would it be to stick that spear in, right? You know? I wish this would be gone. I would like all these problems to go away, and I could fix it right here, right now. Now, I'm hoping that none of you have actually planned out the taking of somebody's life in your mind. If you're thinking about that, I do free counseling, all right? I would encourage you not to go down that path, right? But having said that, if we are honest, aren't there times in which people who are giving us grief, even if we hopefully don't say it out loud, where we wish something would really bad happen to that person who is causing us a problem? I would like to say that I've never thought those things before, but I suspect I'm not alone. And what are we really saying in our heart? I don't value that person. Sometimes people do say it out loud. People say stuff like, screw you, or even wishing that people would go to hell. Think about what people are saying, and maybe you've said such things to people who have given you grief. I just wish you would get it for everything you have done. And I won't ask for a raise of hands, but anyone who's played out scenarios in your mind wishing that something bad would happen to someone who was wrecking your life, you have not valued that life well. And that was not David's tactic. Your life was valued much this day in your eyes. That is a supreme moment of faith by David. This is the Lord's anointed, and I trust that God knows what he's doing in his anointed's life. Wow, that's powerful. We're to value the lives of the people who cause us hurt and grief. And by the way, aren't you glad that Jesus took that route with us? He watched the crowds jeering and mocking and shaming. And what were his words? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. We rightly sing, behold the man upon the cross, my sin upon his shoulders. Ashamed I hear my mocking voice call out among the scoffers. It was my sin that held him there until it was accomplished. His dying breath has brought me life, I know that it is finished. Christ did not take that mindset of devaluing the people who we were really there, who nailed him to the cross. And we should be clear that valuing someone's life is not the same thing as saying we can let sin slide or that justice should not be done. That's not the same thing. David wanted justice. Jesus wants justice. And if you were to go back, even in David's life, to that episode in 1 Samuel 24 where David had the opportunity to kill Saul in the cave, David said to Saul after the fact these words. He says, let the Lord judge between you and me, and let the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you. David believed in justice. He believed in that fully. He wanted justice to be done, but he did not hold out in his mind the life of Saul as worthless, and worthless in such a way that he could do with that life whatever he pleased. And so Saul's soul and life were ultimately for David God's business, not his own. You know, the reality is that we all face pressures from people. And if you're not in one of those seasons in life right now where the pressure is upon you, just wait, you will be. We know this, right? As if you're 15, you're 16, and you're thinking right now, wow, life's hard. Bad news for you. It gets worse, right? Okay. There'll be times when it's great. There's times when it's really bad. That's the nature of living in a fallen world. The question we're faced with is not how do I get rid of pressure? The pressure is going to come. The question we're faced is how do we respond to it? And if we're going to have a righteous right response, I think David shows us. God shows us how. We don't cross the boundaries that God has set up when we're under pressure. We don't justify and say, I will do the wrong thing because you know what? This is just really bad for me right now. We keep trusting in God. We're not moved away and caused to doubt the goodness of God in the midst of our pressures. And third, we value the lives of the people, even the people who are causing us the grief. And we can do all of those things because our God is great. He has given us sure and certain promises. And those promises are for all of eternity. And he is eternally good on his word. Father in heaven, I pray that you would use these words both to encourage and to convict as your Spirit directs into the hearts of each individual here. And we pray these things in the name of Jesus, your Son, and our beautiful Savior. Amen.